Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Caitlin Espelita, assistant producer in VOA's English division. As Iraq struggles to fight against the onslaught of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, a terrorist group which threatens Iraq's sovereignty and territorial integrity, we review the factors that led to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Our guest on this edition of the program is Peter Eisner, journalist and co-author of The Italian Letter, The Forgery That Started the Iraq War. Eisner is a veteran foreign correspondent and has been an editor and reporter at The Washington Post, Newsday, and The Associated Press. He is also the author of The Pope's Last Crusade, How an American Jesuit Helped Pope Pius XI's Campaign to Stop Hitler, about which we interviewed Peter last year. The Italian Letter, which he co-authored with Newt Royce, traces the fraudulent U.S. intelligence prior to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 and reports on the propaganda and misleading information presented by the Republican Bush administration to get American support behind the invasion. We'll talk with Peter about his new book and to what extent the 16 fateful words uttered by former President George W. Bush in his State of the Union address in January 2003, quote, "The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa, may have contributed to the current chaotic situation in Iraq." And Peter Eisner joins us at the VOA Broadcast Center here in Washington to talk about his new book. Welcome to the program.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
And I'm delighted to welcome Katie Espelita to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Peter, congratulations on your book. And what prompted you and Newt Royce to so thoroughly document the forgery, the so-called Italian letter, which alleged that Saddam Hussein was planning to obtain some 500 tons of uranium or that raw material for the purpose of building an atomic weapon?
Well, there are two points. One easy point is to say that we didn't think it had ever been covered as completely as we planned to do. And the second thing was specifically throughout the buildup to the war, and to this very moment, shockingly to me, a majority of Americans still hear and believe what was said at the time, that although there were no weapons of mass destruction ever found in Iraq, we did the best thing we could do based on the intelligence available at the time. That's the point, based on the intelligence available at the time. And we believe that our book makes a case to say that that is just not a true statement. The intelligence was available to see that Iraq was never moving toward producing an atomic bomb.
Well, Peter, how do you think this document gained as much traction as it did within administration circles at the time, even when the Italian journalist who originally got a hold of the documents didn't believe in them to begin with, and her findings were never published?
And even 9 months earlier, when Ambassador Joseph Wilson famously went to Niger and found the same thing, that it was implausible to think that Iraq was trying to purchase uranium or that it was trying to reestablish a 20-year-old nuclear program or that anyone had found any traces of that taking place. So it was highly questionable that that could be the case. But since, at least one day after 9/11 on September 12th, James Woolsey, the former head of the CIA, said that it could very well be that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. That's another point, along with my earlier point, which is that officials and former officials continue to say it was the best available intelligence we had at the time. The second thing is, take a poll. Let's see what percentage of people still think that Iraq could have had some role in 9/11, which it had none. So these are the kinds of things that led to what really was a decision on September 12th that, and it's a deeply cynical decision, perhaps one of the greatest cynical decisions in U.S. history, that a tragedy unparalleled in U.S. history, 9/11, could allow those who think it's time to try to topple Saddam Hussein to look for a subterfuge to invade and overthrow him. And that's exactly what this was.
Let me turn to my colleague, Katie, for a question.
Mr. Eisner, after reading your book, and I was telling you earlier, I was 8 years old at the time. I was so young, didn't really understand the preceding events that led up to the Iraq invasion. But what I don't understand, and even when I was reading the book, was how the Bush administration used these forged documents for the premise on invading. Do you think the administration truly believed that these were a solid foundation to invade? Or they didn't think the American people would find out about it. You said even to this day, they think it's the best available intelligence at the time. How do you think the perception was from the Bush administration when they were using very slim evidence on their basis to invade?
It's a great question. And I think that the one reason that we've reissued our book with updates, and it's now available online, is precisely for people that may not have been there to be able to know the story. As it recedes into history, the story has to be understood in its full context. When you talk about an administration, you're talking about a large ship with lots of people on the ship. At the head of the ship is the president and then the vice president. What they knew and what they thought is hard to tell. But what we do know is that the vast intelligence community of the United States, which importantly includes 16 separate agencies, in a majority discarded three elements of what the Bush administration and with the White House specifically was using as a pretext to war. One of those was the use of aluminum tubes, which supposedly had been imported into Iraq to make centrifuges, which would spin down uranium, which supposedly had been purchased from Niger. And then that would be the way that they would show that it was actually pushing ahead. Vastly and universally, it was shown early on that those aluminum tubes just were not usable for that purpose, technically or any other way, and that they were for rocket parts that are similar to small rockets that are used in many other countries without atomic capabilities or nuclear capabilities or anything like that. Another one was supposedly creation of biological and other chemicals to be used against the world, which was also discarded as being a source that could not be verified. But what was able to hold was the Italian letter, which said that uranium was being purchased. And here's the letter to show that. Although, as we can talk about, the letter was so obviously fraudulent. Since you didn't really need to push the details if you wanted to sell something, the fear of a nuclear bomb and the fear of the purchase of uranium and a good public relations campaign could replace the reality of what many, even inside the administration, were warning was not true. And that's what took place.
Of course, we remember, too, that regardless of evidence or lack thereof, there was a sense that the Bush administration, particularly Vice President Dick Cheney, wanted to invade Iraq. And therefore, this fraudulent evidence, which he somehow interpreted as relevant or actually legitimate, just added to that argument. Do you think without him and his selling of the war, the U.S.-led invasion would have even happened?
The thing that I can say is that in the course of gathering material from dozens of people inside the Bush administration, scientists, intelligence community, diplomats, and others, it becomes clear that Dick Cheney was at the head of the effort to push for war. He certainly was not alone. There were lots of deputies that were pushing for that. But it's clear that he was in a small key group of people that had decided that it was necessary to invade Iraq, topple Saddam Hussein, and then move on to Iran, which was another goal of the group of people that were working on this. It's always hard to say what would have happened if, but it's certainly true that he took an active role that few other vice presidents in U.S. history have ever taken toward war.
Backing up real quick, why did the Italian spies craft this deception in the first place?
There's no absolute answer to that. There are two things to say. One is SISMI, the Italian Military Intelligence Office, which was created in the aftermath of World War II with a lot of help from the then new Central Intelligence Agency and lots of friendships with the Central Intelligence Agency developed in training their operation in the 50s and 60s and beyond. So there's a certain relationship. Notoriously, they're among the freelance agents as opposed to members of SISMI, the Italian military intelligence operation. There were people out to make money, and they saw money to be made in selling documents that might convince and help in the effort toward showing that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. That was one thing before 9/11. After 9/11, it seemed to be more marketable. And then, at the same time, then Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi had become the Bush administration's greatest ally in Western Europe. And he was very happy to provide information that would give bona fides to show that Italy can really help in the effort to fight global terrorism. And those kinds of things operated together to make Italy just a perfect source. It was just also an effective piece of material that arrived on the desk of especially the Defense Intelligence Agency, more than CIA, that was used. We don't know what American, if any, contact was involved toward the production of that. There's just no information. There's lots of speculation. I couldn't speak to it.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Peter Eisner, journalist and co-author of The Italian Letter, The Forgery That Started the Iraq War. And I'm Carol Castiel, along with Katie Espelita, assistant producer in VOA's English division. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. Also, we love to hear from you, so please send your feedback on guests and topics to PCUSA@voanews.com. Make sure to like us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. Tell us where you're from and if you listen to PCUSA via the radio or the internet. And certainly, please leave a comment. Here's a shout out to Sebe Kulu Israel, a loyal listener from South Africa. And now a question from Katie.
Mr. Eisner, I want to briefly touch on the PR campaign that you mentioned earlier. When reading through your book, you talk about this propaganda campaign that they had scheduled to plan a week before the year anniversary of September 11th. And I'm going to quote your book, Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense at the time, saying that the administration used WMD as a key rationale for war because Hussein's brutality against his own people was not a reason to put Americans' kids' life at risk. And you talk about the administration going on all these shows using the same phrases, the mushroom cloud, don't let that be the smoking gun. Can you please elaborate a little bit more on this campaign and maybe its effectiveness to instill that fear?
Right. The organization put together was called the White House Interagency Group, and key members of State Department, Defense, and the White House and others were in this group, and it was a public relations plan, pure and simple. Not only did they decide to do it for the one-year anniversary of 9/11, it was also just saying September is a good start. You don't want to go into a campaign too early while people are on vacation. It's a good news start to a story. So they laid the groundwork in a very methodical way, including bringing in reporters from newspapers, notably the New York Times, to say, using anonymous sources, everybody knows that Saddam Hussein is trying to rebuild his nuclear capacity. And the weight of that in Washington gave it space that it might not have been given. But just in case the New York Times and people might not be reading the New York Times or material be circulating at the moment, also because Twitter and Facebook were and other social media were not operating at the same level they are in 2014, they went to every network and they sent out Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz, the vice president himself, and the language was scripted. We may not be sure 100%, but do we want to wait until we see a mushroom cloud, they would say? And it was simply fear-mongering. And it was based ultimately on the fact that the only thing that Americans would pay attention to accept the concept of what was essentially a preemptive war, would be the danger of nuclear weapons. And there, of all of the possibilities, the Italian letter, fraudulent though it was to many, was perfect. So that was the perfect backup to the PR campaign that they were organizing.
And then when did everyone realize that this intelligence was basically unfounded, bogus? By then, the war had started. Is that right?
Well,
pretty much so. And then other rationale came into play. Well, he's a bad guy. He oppresses the Shia, the Kurds, etc.
Well, a few days before the March 20th, 2003 invasion of Iraq, Mohammed El-Baradei, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said categorically that this is a fraud. None of this exists. And that followed up a report that his agency had issued, a UN agency that it was, with thousands of pages showing why this was not true and showing why nothing was to be found. And the Bush administration said he's wrong, we disagree with him. But when we say, when did everybody realize? Even while years later, when we were preparing for the book, I went to the head of British intelligence, Richard Dearlove, and said, why did President Bush say in his 16 words, the British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa? Why the British government? Is that something separate? He said, oh yes, that's something separate. Well, what would that be? Well, that's classified. So to this hour, more than a decade later, the British actually still say that there was information other than the Italian letter, widely believed not to be the case. They may not still say because they try not to raise the issue, but the Tony Blair government said that. So it was widely known and widely analyzed because it was so obvious to see the forgery and the absurdity of this purchase of uranium from Niger. Many saw that it was worth throwing away, including the CIA station chief in Rome, who threw it in the garbage at first.
Well, that leads me to one more question before I turn to Katie, and that is, how is it that the intelligence community did not override the White House, absolutely demand that they not use this bogus evidence?
Some were intimidated, some were fooled, and some just threw up their hands and said, whether we complain or not, we're still going to war. So there was kind of like this juggernaut moving forward.
Former U.S. Ambassador of Saudi Arabia, Chaz Freeman, described Iraq as a hit-and-run democratization. So my question to you is, did we leave Iraq too soon? Could things have been done at the end of the Bush administration and the transition to the Obama administration before we pulled out that would have forestalled the current outcome that we're seeing today?
My view would not be my view alone. What I think is that it was almost impossible to stay long enough to impose an American solution to Iraq governance. What happened in 2003 was the ripping apart of a coalition of forces that allowed a small Sunni group led by Saddam Hussein and the military to run the country and to have more or less status quo. And more or less have Kurds in the north who allow all of this to come together and remain one country and with relative cohesion as a country. It's not for me or any American to talk to that too much. Was it in 2003 an American problem because did Iraq present a clear and present danger to the security of the United States? I think the answer would be no, and I'm not alone. So once you've destroyed the natural course of events, even though you didn't like it, it was not American-style democracy by any means. And there was violence, and Saddam Hussein was a strong man and every epithet you want to give to him. But once you destroy the structure, and it's not the only time, you create a situation and an imbalance which you may never be able to repair. So what we're seeing now is a delayed civil war. There may not be any resolution, no matter how long you stay there.
But no question, Peter Eisner, I mean, so many people, analysts, Democrats, Republicans along the political spectrum have denounced this U.S.-led invasion as a strategic blunder, and we were pivoting away from the real perpetrators of 9/11, the Taliban and al-Qaeda based in Afghanistan, and we pivoted away from that to Iraq, and that was the disaster. However, let me ask a follow-up to what Katie asked, and that is this. Even if the invasion was a strategic blunder, had the Bush administration managed the aftermath of the war in a more responsible way, had they not disbanded the Iraqi army, had they not banned all Ba'ath Party members from participating in the government or the army, could things have possibly turned out differently? Or was deposing Saddam Hussein by force, imposing democracy, as it were, at the barrel of a gun, which then ushered in this first Shia-dominated Arab state and therefore strengthening Iran, posing a threat to Sunni Gulf states, just a bridge too far for the region?
I think that in context, you can say that, sure, if it had been managed better and if it had been more intelligently handled, there still was a way to make something positive out of it. But I also was present in Panama during the U.S. invasion in 1989. And by the way, Colin Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Dick Cheney was defense secretary, and George Walker Bush was the president. And the first thing that the United States did after deposing Manuel Antonio Noriega, who I can say I've also written with a memoir about his life, the first thing that the United States did was to depose the Panamanian military and to impose a president who was not universally liked, and there were questions about his background. And the imposition of a new structure in a very much smaller place which didn't have oil was short-term chaos. The reason that things changed in Panama probably was because the nature of Panama was different. But from the United States standpoint, and in 1989, it was just that war and that invasion was just as significant as later the Iraq War was, and they mishandled it the exact same way. Disband the military, despite complaints from within the U.S. government saying, you can't do that, you're going to destroy the normal course of events, they did it. And so there's somewhat of a profile in which the United States handles post-invasion. They deeply mismanaged the idea that they could disband the military, assuming that no one in the military could possibly care about governance, could provide a structure or anything like that. And now we find 11 years later that suddenly members of the Iraqi military are not only somewhat involved in the revolt, but some people in the intelligence community in the United States think that their participation and their ability possibly to subsume the far more violent and far more dangerous, in intelligent view, ISIL, could lead to a new stability. That new stability, strangely, would be, if you listen to those intelligence analysts, and they're significant ones, would be a Sunni military government, which we had before March 20th, 2003, with some kind of understanding with some elements of Shia to find some kind of new balance, if possible. The other possibility, obviously, is that Iraq breaks up into three pieces, Kurds, Shia, and Sunni.
Let me turn to Katie for another question.
I'm going to turn to the new president. July 24th, Iraq's parliament picked a new president, Fuad Masoum. And you suggested maybe a Sunni-led military. I want to hear your predictions for the prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki. Do you think he'll be strong-armed? Do you think he'll step down? Because that's the position that everyone's looking at to see who's going to fill those shoes or if it will change.
Yeah, it's very hard after all these years as a foreign correspondent to make predictions about what might happen. Talking to intelligence sources, I hear that the constituted Iraqi army has a lot of difficulty fighting the increasingly strong forces against them, and they're finding tough going, and also morale is a question. So what capability does the Iraqi state as it exists have to continue operating the way it's operating? Would there be a mediation? Would there be some kind of attempt at bringing back in all parties to come up with some kind of ceasefire and solution? Not easy to say. All I can say is that when it's all over, the status quo won't look like probably it does now. There'll be a different array of forces and a different bunch of people in charge. Now, what the future of the existing Iraqi parliament and the existing elections and Maliki, it's just too hard to understand where that might go.
Last couple of questions, Peter Eisner. Fast forward, of course, to the Obama administration. I think one can objectively say that the results of what happened in Iraq, the U.S.-led invasion, the responsibility lies with the Bush administration for invading in the first place on false premises and then for mishandling the aftermath. But many across the political spectrum are disenchanted with President Obama, his handling of foreign policy. Some say that he actually, and I quote, overlearned Iraq, that is, because of the blunders made by the Bush administration, that he disengaged too much from the world, whether Iraq or Syria, that he didn't intervene forcefully enough in Syria, if he ignored his so-called red line. What are your thoughts with regard to that critique? Perhaps Obama didn't intervene or project leadership enough.
Well, of course, his one-time opponent for the presidency, John McCain, says things much stronger than that, saying that you have to take a stand, you have to show that America is strong. The United States was deeply weary with its presence in Iraq, and it was not achieving benefits. President Obama had promised to pull out of Iraq. There had been hundreds of millions of dollars invested in training and democratization, and a plan was put together, and he left. My argument, again, would be that once you've interrupted the natural course of a country's governance and progress through history, you can't predict what the outcome is going to be, and it can't always be short-term a happy ending. So we are where we are right now, and not clear to say where that ends up. In the case of Syria, I think it's misread. President Obama used the words red line. He probably wished he didn't use them. But despite what was said, he made a deal with Vladimir Putin that actually has just recently completed the isolation of chemical weapons in Syria without resorting to military action. As every military commander will tell you and has told me, it has to be the last possible resort once you enter a war, once you start attacking, you don't know where things will land.
Of course, on the other side, military strikes do not necessarily equal an act of war. And also now Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, has killed so many more innocents with conventional weapons than he did with those chemical weapons. But that's another topic for another day. Last question, what lessons have we learned from this Iraq war, from your book, that we can say that we've learned something about how not to use discredited intelligence, the role of the press? Have we made progress since then?
Well, that's a great last question, and I don't know. I hope that journalists and people that write books like this are not just shouting into the wind. We think the best thing you can ask for is an American public and electorate that develops information and its own mass critical analysis and thinking so that they can say, do not take the word that you see on television of the moment to be the only answer. We have a lot of information bombarding us every day about every story, and context is everything. How did it get to that point? How do you wade back to a point where you can even begin to understand extricating yourself or changing a situation that seems to be intractable? So all I can say is that the more context that people hear to understand not to believe what's first before them is the better. And so to that extent, this is just a cry to say things can get better if people understand the context in which public affairs and momentary events take place and try to listen to all sides. And maybe the best thing we can say is that blind ideology is not the answer to good governance.
The book is The Italian Letter, The Forgery That Started the Iraq War. The author, journalist Peter Eisner. Peter, thanks so much for coming in, talking about your book, sharing your terrific insights.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Nick Ivanov. And joining me on the program was Caitlin Espelita. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.